This is fine. It's very nice. But the problem is they leave the back door open. So you have all these people, the latest one being this person who put these documents on a gaming platform, folded them up, put it in his pocket, and walked out the door. So you have this failure at the end. You have success at the beginning in order to collect the intelligence. But you have the failure at the end to protect the intelligence.
James Bamford, longtime investigative journalist, author of Spy Fail, Foreign Spies, Moles, Saboteurs, and the Collapse of America's Counterintelligence. Visit democracynow.org to see part one of our conversation with Bamford, talking about how the leaked documents are based on intelligence gathered by the National Reconnaissance Office, the NRO, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the National Security Agency. On Tuesday, National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby urged reporters not to cover the leaked documents, saying, quote, it has no business on the front pages of newspapers or on television. It's not intended for public consumption, and it should not be out there, he said. That does it for our show.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
Give us talking points and false choice after false choice, and there's no prominent voices on the left. Five companies own everything you read, hear, and see. Misleading the people, still calling it freedom of the press. Disaster of epic proportions, they got us all in, traitors in our midst. Screwed over when corporations bought in to Congress. Representatives of representing mostly lobbyists, while the typical oblivious American is fine with all this. Given the daily dose of celebrity gossip, government held hostage, we kicked the worst out of office. But at the core it remains rotten regardless. Now how much can you rob the system before it can be classified as white collar crime? This is class warfare. This is class warfare. This is class warfare. How much can you rob the system before it can be classified as white collar crime? This is class warfare.
And good morning, everybody. Gotta turn up my mic. This is Paul Roland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Great to be with you. I am here flying solo, so look forward to a focused conversation. I'll talk about what I mean by that in a bit. That was Chris Priest with Class Warfare. I would like to talk about war and resistance. Resistance to war. What is the war? Class war, war against empire. There's all kinds of wars going on, hot wars, cold wars. We live in an empire. Do we realize this? How do we resist the empire? Lots of good questions. Anyway, I'll be here for the hour, and I look forward to talking with you at 503-231-8187. So yeah, a focused or guided conversation. We're not really used to that. Maybe, you know, some seminars at university, maybe some really good teachers are able to have that kind of conversation. You know, there's support groups. There's different, mostly like things like AA tend to be people sharing their own stories, but not necessarily real interplay of conversation. You know, I don't know, what are the places where we can have good, focused conversations where, you know, people don't just sort of say whatever that comes into their mind or, you know, whatever's on their mind in the moment. Don't just, where we actually try to get somewhere, where we try to come together in real engagement, in conversation. You know, which could be a metaphor for the broader problem of people actually coming together in focused resistance against all the terrible calamities that are upon us. guided conversation. So I obviously would be the guide. I'm the one behind the microphone. But I don't want to, you know, just like completely set the agenda. I'm really interested in what people have to say. But, you know, a lot of times we do need some sort of focus or guidance. You know, I've been in groups, you know, consensus groups that tend to be fairly disciplined, where people know, you know, where people are working towards a common goal, and where so people are, you know, you're planning some kind of campaign, some kind of action, where that, you know, you really have to keep focused on that and not get off on, you know, whatever, people's personal issues too much. You know, if there's conflicts in the group, you have to deal with that. But it's a position that I take seriously. I try to do a good job. I find that a lot of time, you know, if there's a conversation that is focused, sometimes people will call in and go off in a, you know, different direction. It's hard because there's so much that people want to talk about. There's so much that's on our minds. So I understand it, but I'd really like to try to keep us focused today. I'd also really like to hear from, you know, people who don't usually call in, less frequent callers. I appreciate all the longtime callers. I appreciate everybody who calls in and, you know, wants to put their voice out there. It's not necessarily easy. I don't have an easy time calling in to talk shows. I don't know, probably KBOO. I don't call into talk shows just because I host one, but generally. But I have called into some national talk shows and, you know, sometimes some right-wing talk shows, and I get nervous, frankly. So I understand it's, you know, it's kind of hard to keep your thoughts together in the moment sometimes. Anyway, so I understand all those issues, but it's a good practice. It's good practice, public speaking. I don't know if any of you are involved in any kind of public speaking groups. Some of those are kind of cool. So yeah, so I want to talk about this issue. I want to sort of start off. I guess I was kind of I was inspired by the so-called Tennessee Three, the mini uprising there in Memphis, where a whole bunch of people, you know, and now you're getting the right wing talk shows, you know, comparing that to January 6th, you know, oh, they're insurrection. They, you know, they got off easy. They're not going to prison. I mean, come on. We all know that's a bunch of ridiculous misdirection. But, you know, and of course, you know, who's right and who's wrong? Big question. Are we actually headed towards a civil war, which a lot of people have been talking about for the last few years? I want to talk a little bit about that. I want to talk about the concept of civil resistance as opposed to civil war. But yeah, I was inspired by the two Justins who stood up and their female white colleague whose name I can't remember right now. But I thought they were all very well spoken. I thought they really, you know, they seized the moment. And they seized the moment, not just at the time, you know, on the floor of the Tennessee House of Representatives, but they continued afterwards. They got into the media spotlight, and I think they used that quite well. As I said, I think they're really well spoken. And what really stood out, and why I got that song by Chris Priest, I was looking for a song that mentioned the word lobbyist, that they really were focusing on the NRA lobbyists. And I think that's a really good strategic focus. I think the lobbyists are the foot soldiers of this this war upon the populace, this massive infusion of guns and guns of warfare in a domestic setting. Just keep pumping them out and pumping them. And then they find their way to conflicts all over the globe. You know, the U.S. is one of the probably the main armor of conflicts in the world. Both these domestic incidents like mass shootings and the all the shootings that go on, accidental or intentional, and you know, civil wars, actual wars between nations, and the lobbyists. The, you know, we could talk about the NRA lobbyists, but why leave out the weapons contractor, the arms contractors, the armors of the Pentagon and other nations? So lobbyists, I think, is a really key place. They're not the, you know, they don't set the policy. You know, got to ultimately go after the Pentagon, but the lobbyists are really key role in, you know, the corruption of Congress, the capturing of Congress, and the skewing of the all the policy issues against any kind of you know, any sane reduction in the massive use of amount of guns floating around in society, etc. So that was one of the songs I found when I put in the keyword of songs with the word lobbyists in it. And anyway, most of the others, unfortunately, have too many expletives that can't go out over our public airwaves. And in fact, that one in the next second verse, there was immediately one, so we had to cut that short. Really good song, worth checking out. Chris Priest, Class Warfare. Are we in a class warfare? I'm going to have to pick up on my Facebook page so I can see who's calling in. But I did want to read something first. This is a there's a bunch of things I kind of want to, little pieces to this puzzle. So hold on, caller. But I was reading this book by one of my old favorites, Eric Fromm. It's actually a book called The Dogma of Christ and Other Essays on Religion, Psychology, and Culture. But this is, I just happened to look at this chapter called The Revolutionary Character. You know, I've talked about this whole long debate over reform versus revolution. And, you know, what would it mean? What would a revolution mean? You know, what does it mean to be a revolutionary? Anyway, so the concept of the revolutionary character is a political psychological one. In this respect, it resembles the concept of the authoritarian character, which was introduced into psychology about 30 years ago. Of course, this was written, I think, in the 40s or so. The latter combined a political category, that of the authoritarian structure in state and family, with a psychological category, the character structure, which forms the basis for such a political and social structure. You know, this is something that, that there was a lot of talk about this, you know, around the middle of the last century, especially in reaction to the rise of fascism. And, you know, Eric Fromm, Reich, Wilhelm Reich, a whole bunch of people were talking about this. The concept of the authoritarian character was born out of certain political interests. Around 1939-30 in Germany, we wanted to ascertain what the chances were. This is really fascinating. I always wondered more about, you know, what the real thinking people in Germany, how they dealt with the rise of Hitler. And, you know, I haven't, I'm sure I could have read more about it, but it's just really interesting to come across it. It really answered some questions. We wanted to ascertain what the chances were for Hitler's being defeated by the majority of the population. In 1930, the majority of the German population, especially the workers and employees, were against Nazism. They were on the side of democracy, as had been demonstrated by political and shop steward elections. The question was whether they would fight for their ideas in the event that it came to a fight. The premise was that it was one thing to have an opinion and another to have a conviction. Now remember that, the difference between an opinion and a conviction. Or, to put it differently, anyone can acquire an opinion, just as one can learn a foreign language or a foreign custom, but only those opinions which are rooted in the character structure of a person, behind which there is the energy contained in their character, only those opinions become convictions. The effect of ideas, while these are easy to accept if the majority proclaims them, depends to a large extent on the character structure of a person in a critical situation. And again, I think of those two lawmakers in Tennessee, the character structure of a person in a critical situation, and they really rose to the occasion. Anyway, character, as Heraclitus said and Freud demonstrated, is the fate of man, or humankind, they all used man then. The character structure decides what kind of an idea a person will choose and also decides the force of the idea he has chosen. That is indeed the great importance in Freud's concept of character that transcends the traditional concept of behavior and speaks to that behavior which is dynamically charged. Anyway, I just want to go on because get to the meat of this. The question which we asked at that time was, to what extent do German workers and employees have a character structure which is opposite to the authoritarian idea of Nazism? And that implied still another question. To what extent will the German workers and employees in the critical hour fight Nazism? A study was made, and the result was that, roughly speaking, 10% of the German workers and employees had what we call an authoritarian character structure. About 15% had a democratic character structure. And the vast majority, about 75%, were people whose character structure was a mixture of both extremes. The theoretical assumption was that the authoritarians would be ardent Nazis, the, quote, democratic ones, militant anti-Nazis, and that the majority would be neither one nor the other. These theoretical assumptions turned out to be more or less accurate, as events in the years between 1933 and 1945 allowed. For our purpose now, it may suffice to say that the authoritarian character structure is the character structure of a person whose sense of strength and identity is based on a symbiotic subordination to authorities. Anyway, it goes on and sort of analyzes. I just found that really fascinating that they basically called it. That basically, when push comes to shove, most of the people were going to go along with the, you know, what turned out to be the, when they seized state power, the Nazis, they basically, that was it. They, you know, most people ended up going along with it at that point, you know, more or less willingly or unwillingly. Anyway, I just thought, you know, while one can't, people have drawn parallels between, you know, the current situation, not just in the United States, but a lot of places. There's a backsliding toward authoritarianism, as people say, around the world, including, you know, with Trumpism. And not just, you know. I think, you know, this war in Ukraine is demonstrating that a lot of people are going along with the program because that's what the mass media and that's what all the governments and that's what, you know, that's what people are saying. That's what all the talking heads are saying, most of them. And that's dangerous because I think we could be headed towards a very, very serious, potentially world war, especially now inciting China, et cetera. Anyway, so, you know, I'm just saying, think about it. And what we can do to both reinforce our own, develop our own character structures and support each other so that we have more people who are on the democratic side. Okay, so that's sort of one of the premises. And then there's this, an article I came across in the New Yorker, The Anti-Coup. There's professor of, I can't find her name. Anyway, she wrote a new book called Civil Resistance, What Everyone Needs to Know. Chenoweth, Erica Chenoweth. And I find that very fascinating, the difference between civil resistance and civil war. Okay, so looks like we've been having a person on the line. So, I don't have your name, so go ahead and identify yourself and say what you have to say.
My name is Santiago. You know, I think this is a really important conversation. The one something that I really want people to understand is that, first of all, you know, authoritarianism, the way that it's used in the media, is basically a buzzword for, like, non-Western governments that choose to use the resources in a non-capitalistic way. You know, many of us do not have an education or very little education about governments or countries outside of our own. And really, I mean, that's really just a part of what it means to be a quote-unquote American. You know, like, we don't, you know, they say, like, you know, well, you want a person who speaks two languages and is bilingual, but a person who speaks one language is American. But anyway, the point is that, you know, our idea, you know, is a Michael Parenti had talked about the idea of the conscious human agency, and that's what holds together a society. And when I talk to anarchists, because I'm a communist, I talk to anarchists, and the one thing we get in the fight over is the state. And it's like, you know, you can't keep social cohesion without conscious human agency. Now, the thing is people don't realize that America is an authoritarian state. All states are authoritarian because they have a conscious human agency that holds things together. Now, what we have to ask ourselves is whether or not that conscious human agency is being used to protect the good of the people or the good of corporations.
Wait a second. So you say they're authoritarian because they have conscious human agency?
I'm saying that conscious human agency automatically implies authoritarianism because of the fact that you need to have a final authority in the say of what stays and what goes.
Well, isn't there a difference between authoritarianism and authority? I mean, I think that's
I don't think so. I think that's splitting hairs, because at the end of the day, people call Cuba authoritarian and they call China authoritarian, but at the same time, who fared better in COVID? You know, who is actually using their resources to material benefit the people?
Well,
Cuba just passed a law that actually recognizes intentional family opposed to biological family in creating a family structure, something that the United States has not even begun to breach, let alone trying to tear back the rights of.
Well, listen.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Okay. Hold on. Slow down. I think this could easily become just sort of a one conversation between me and you, because everything you've brought up and everything I've brought up just implies a really extensive, you know, trying to come to understanding of even just the terms we're using, let alone how we're using those terms. So,
yeah.
First of all, I would say, no, I think you can draw authority is, you know, it comes from author, which means, you know, anyway, I wasn't prepared exactly for this, but authoritarianism implies some sort of more structural, you know, you can be an authority on a subject because you know the subject, because you've studied it, and what you say has, you know, more validity than someone who hasn't studied it. So you are an authority because, you know, either you're a scholar, you're a scientist, you're a technician, you're an authority in that field. So that's, you know, that's an authority. Authoritarianism implies, to me, you know, some sort of structure in which there is this very strong top-down decision-making in which, you know, the common people basically don't have much say. And I do think that applies to China, which is why I don't like the Chinese system, just like I don't like the United States system. I don't like the Russian system. I don't like most of the systems. Cuba, you know, it seems to me to be more mixed. It seems like it certainly started out very, very democratically. And then I think it did contain some of those authoritarian elements. And I think as a reaction to the extreme pressure they're put under, because, you know, global capitalism can't abide any exception. And so, you know, it became encircled, the embargoes. And so in reaction to that, they did ally themselves with states that, you know, I think the Soviet Union was a very, authoritarian in the bad sense that I'm saying, you know. Are there examples of countries that aren't authoritarian? I think there are some. But again, that's what all of this is.
But we often attribute the non-authoritarians to Western nations.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that's the only definition.
No, I'm not saying that's the only definition, but I'm talking about functional. I'm talking about working in the real world. And that's really what it comes down to. What we need you know, is we need to be able to create concrete definitions for what we're seeing around us. Like people will say that, you know, they'll say like, oh, you know, communists or fascists. And it's like, you know, you got to talk about how it comes into play. You know, people talk about, you know, Stalin being a fascist and Hitler being a fascist. But it's like, first of all, who sacrificed more soldiers in the defeat of Nazism? And number two, what does fascism actually look like? And the definition that works the best, that all around, is palingenic ultranationalism, meaning a society that's in decay, in the throes of decay, looking to rebirth itself through this sense of national, like one static coherent of nationalism.
Right.
And I'm just saying, man, like, people like to go rounds about this and talk about it, but the thing is like, there's only been two countries in the course of history that have created and stood the test of time a system that goes against capitalism. And I'm not saying that they were perfect systems by any measure of the imagination. Also remembering the fact that, like, the U.S. has basically done everything it could in the last 80, 90 years to squash any sort of alternate organization of economy, whether it was in Russia, whether it was in China, whether it was in Cuba, all throughout Latin America, you know, in the Caribbean. I mean, they taking people out to basically murder them as a proof. And then they'll say, oh, well, communism has never worked because it's never been viable. It's like, no, you send America in with enough forces to squash it out, then all of a sudden it doesn't work.
Right,
and
but
then
hold
on. Like, oh, well, it can't work.
Okay, so hold on a second. So, okay, I think there's something really important in what we're talking about in itself, but I think it's important in the broader context of, for example, the Ukraine war, the discussion over NATO, et cetera, because we're repeating the Cold War debates in different ways. So I think it's really important to be clear about what we really, you know, what the nature of all these systems really was, why they came to be, and it's the kind of thing that most, you know, the vast majority of people aren't going to really have the tools, second of all, the time and the places in order to do that. You know, you have to be in some ways either be involved in some, you know, revolutionary group that still has a study group and really gets into this stuff, or you have to be, advanced, you know, student, postgraduate student, even to begin to understand the real historical basis of a lot of stuff. Okay, so that said,
hold on.
So, I think, you know, I'm talking about really in depth, you know, the broad outlines. Sure. Okay. I think we all can do that. But so what do we think this whole idea of communism just keeps coming around, and a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of confusion around it. There's a lot of misunderstanding around it. And I think it's really important because we keep, first of all, you know, the left keeps getting labeled as socialists and communists. Obviously, that's a dog whistle by the, you know, Fox News and the more extreme elements of the right wing. And so, you know, do we have to listen to that? Yeah, to extent, because they have the ear of a lot of people. So the ability to propagandize on the basis of these simplistic understandings of the world is really strong. So we have to, you know, we have to combat it. So I think that it seems to me, just sort of almost reactionary to just like defend Stalin without having a real critique of the nature of the Soviet system.
We should have a critique of Stalin, absolutely. But the problem is that nobody wants to actually engage in that critique. They just want to call. They just want to say, oh, blah, 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 Molotov, Ribbentrop, ha ha, Stalin, Hitler, Stalinism. You know, they don't want to. You know, they don't want to engage with that. You know, they don't want to engage with the fact that Stalin had to do in 10 years what took a lot of people 100 years in order to defend the U.S.S.R. You know what I mean? Like, and the fact that, like, all of this stuff was going on under a regime of embargoes and basically, like, counter-revolutionary issues on the side of NATO and Western nations, which were Nazi-washing schemes. You know, look up the history of NASA and the history of NATO if you want to see how many Nazis were democracy-washed in there. But the thing is that, like, the thing is that there's no clear-cut answer, but all liberals want are clear-cut answers. They want to be able to say who's the good guy, who's the bad guy. But the truth is that the war in Ukraine right now was a direct result of the fact that NATO and the U.S. Basically worked to hasten the unraveling of the USSR. And now you have Zelensky and Putin, who are basically just monsters created out of a Western
right. But it was also a result of some of the contradictions within the Soviet system, and even further back, of, you know, Russia was imperialist going way back. I mean, I've been reading some books of some of the suppressed nationalities, you know, Poland, Lithuania, which included Ukraine mostly. You know, there's they've been fighting against the Russians forever, and so it's easy for them.
Absolutely.
It's easy for them to use that history to buttress their current struggle, you know, without really going into anyway. We got to cut this short because we got another caller, and we've already taken up probably a quarter of the time.
Give me your last thought,
and then we'll go on.
Well, basically, what I'm going to say is that, you know, we can take this all down to individualist history and all these little things, but we have to understand that the capitalist juggernaut has been in play for over 100 years and will exacerbate any fissures, any sort of, like, backbiting or historical struggles in order to maintain itself. And so that's why we need to stop identifying with the system that we live under and start trying to look at things from a vantage point of, like, what if I was just dropped here and had to study the history to know what side I need to be on? Because right now, a lot of Americans are identified. It's not really the fact that America is a democracy. It's that people have identified with what they think democracy is and not really questioning it outside of that. So it's going to be hard for us to have rational discussions when people are irrationally clinging to something that they hold as familiar.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That was well stated and always good to hear from you. And, I think we have another caller. Not sure who that is.
George.
Looks like it's George. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Paul. Thank you. There is a book which puts forward the unpopular idea, at least if you listen to the mass media in America or even to cable now and then, the unpopular idea that Stalin was not really a dictator. Stalin was not really a mass murderer. Stalin was rather a realistic leader caught with the Soviet Union in the deliberate attempt since 1917 to destroy the Soviet Union.
And so how does that help us now? How does that contribute to the conversation we're having about civil resistance?
It contributes because it shows that much of the kind of conversation that is out there that talks about the evil socialists or the evil communists, including Mao, is really based upon mythology.
Right. Well, actually, I've read...
A minute. The book by Grover Fuhr was based on 14 years of study of the, I guess you could call them, the popular ideas put out by the mass media in this country about the Soviet Union and Stalin. And I would mention this book, and if I can give you the title, people really should have a look at this.
Okay, what's the title?
The title is Blood Lies. The subtitle is The Evidence That Every Accusation Against Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union in Timothy Snyder's Bloodlands is False.
That seems like a pretty blanket statement there. It sounds
it's a long 600 almost so, 600 page
so,
book.
So have you read Timothy Snyder's response?
I did not read Professor Snyder's book. I read this book, and I can only
So maybe that, you should actually read the other side.
Let me just Grover Fur takes Professor Timothy Snyder's book Bloodlands, which is a book about the what Snyder feels the Soviet Union was, a state engaged in the mass murder of its own citizens by Stalin and his colleagues. Grover Fur's book, Blood Lies, takes Professor Snyder's book paragraph by paragraph and analyzes it.
Okay.
And
well,
he
thank
comes
you.
Up with a counter argument, and I think I don't know whether Professor Grover Fur is right or whether the people who say that Stalin was a mass murderer are right.
Well, I don't think it's just mass murder. I think
if
that
a
he
person will just read.
Okay.
This book.
Okay, we got it. We got it.
Yeah,
thank you.
That's good. That's
thank
all
you.
I need.
So it's hard to have a discussion sometimes with you, George, but I appreciate your calling in. So it's not just the accusation, not just that he was a mass murderer, it's that his decisions also led to like mass starvation and stuff, that you know, and that he created a system of people spying on each other. And so I don't know, you could I guess dispute all those things too, but yeah, I think we do need to relook. I think Stalin was a human being. You know, he came of a certain place and time. He was caught in he was in a certain system, and he acted, you know, did he abuse his power? I think he abused his power. I think almost every nation state abuses their power. Every nation state is a mini empire virtually, because almost all of them have suppressed long historical minorities and created a mythical entity. Very, very few exceptions. There's a few smaller states that, you know, are roughly corresponding. You know, my former co-host Jacqueline Keeler often talked about the indigenous nations and talking about their claims to nationhood. So, you know, nation is a very complex. Is the nation state separate, different from that? These are really important questions. But yeah, my take is that any large system like that, using the kinds of mass tools of propaganda and mass organization and basically enforcing from above certain policies towards certain ends, you know, were those necessary in the historical international context? One can argue that. But I think we're aiming for something different. You know, we're aiming to break free from the system of empire and empires in general. And the system of capitalism. Anyway, I could go on and on. Do we have any other callers? It looks like not yet. Maybe we got one coming. 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I started talking about, you know, what I think is our major, and I've said this repeatedly, our major task as people in the United States is to fight our own empire. And then to join in with other people fighting their empires and fight on an international global basis against capitalism, empire, patriarchy, you know, a tall task. But we have to start with where we are. And that's why I was so inspired once again by the Tennessee Three, the people who really, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement was really inspiring. People getting up in the streets and taking direct action, protesting. What I find really interesting is, you know, because I believe that we have to, you know, I'm not completely sort of I don't think the revolution is going to happen just by, you know, it doesn't seem we have it within us at this point to create the kind of mass movement that's separate from mainstream institutions. So I thought it was interesting that people in the heart of the mainstream institutions, you know, these two young and one slightly older, the two young men, black men, the two Justins and the older white woman, standing up within the Tennessee legislature and with the backing of the people. That's a model that I've seen it happen other places. I saw it happen in a small valley in northwest Italy against a intrusive high-speed train thrust down their into the heart of their valley. It's a big conversation, I know, gets into the whole issue of so-called green technologies. But they rose up, and you had a lot of the mayors of the small towns along with the people. And I've seen a few other situations where elected officials joined together with a movement. And I think that's a valuable model. You know, we've seen it to some extent here in Portland. So anyway, that's a conversation that I was hoping to have more, is how do we move towards a larger civil resistance where we are without necessarily engaging in some of the historical, rhetorical debates that have plagued the left for so long. So with that, let's hear what Ruth has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Well, thank you so much. I like the idea of being an active person, and I am grateful for being a citizen of the United States of America. And traveling over to different parts of the world, we do see, you know, how different things have happened, and throughout history, there's lots of spin-off conversations to this. But I love that you're bringing up that there are really nice pools of things happening and changing, where there's room in the United States. There's room in our government for the proper presentation of ideas and liberties, so that we can walk through our streets into our parks and, you know, have our kids and try not to be at anxiety level 10, you know, every time we take them to school or to a park because there's a camp. Because so many people around us are more and more becoming more present moment and participating on maybe their neighborhood councils or at their schools. And I think that it's slowly forming, because I believe that we have the potential to be great. And having seen some other places
to be great. What do you mean? What does that mean?
What's that?
We have the potential to be great. What does that mean?
I think that we have the potential to be our ideal. You know, I think we have.
What's our ideal?
What do you think your ideal is of America? Because it's so individual.
Well, I don't really believe in America as maybe in the same way that you do. I think we're a colony that imposes itself on a very amazing diversity of cultures that in many ways were more advanced than the European culture, which imposed itself and then imposed a chattel slavery system, which dragged a bunch of Africans from their homelands and brought them here and created a system that I think is actually ended up being monstrous. It became an empire. We imposed our power on the Philippines.
You could go that way for sure. I mean, if you look at the colonization, you know, the history is filled with things that are really, really tragic. But I think that your conversation that you want to have is more like, what are we doing now? Right? Because
right, but if we don't understand how we got here, how do we change it?
Well, right, exactly. And so that's my point. My point is that, you know, by having this conversation, I think that the focal point can be the individual is here and we're being more active and putting a spotlight more on. We have these town hall meetings and, you know, what is going good, and focusing on how each of us in our little communities can be, you know, more kind, and highlighting that. I see your point, and I don't want to focus on how, you know, things are unraveling and how it's chaos and how this is the empire.
Right, but we live in an empire. We can't avoid the fact that we live in an empire.
I think, what's the definition of an empire?
What's what?
What's the definition of an empire?
It's a national power that expands and imposes itself on others outside its boundaries, like England did, like France did,
right,
like the United States has done. We still have colonies. Guam is a colony. Puerto Rico is a colony. We have a bunch of colonies. You know, right. we itself are a colony. We still colonize indigenous nations. We haven't, you know, but again, you know, what does that have to do with the, you know, the kind of things you're talking about in the, you know, the quality of life in Portland, Oregon? I think it has everything to do because, you know, we're
benefiting from that, from the empire that you defined. We as Americans and United States citizens, we benefit, like our ability to influence and have change, you know, it's something that we can harness. And it's not something to be hopeless about. It's something to absolutely, you know, moving forward. It's something to, you know, embrace your passions and find some kindness and do the right thing and be very, very careful about the language that we use.
Mm-hmm.
And just affirmative terms. And
so the empire is something we can harness? Is that what you said?
It absolutely is something. It's our government, you know, and we are interested in what's happening in the world. And it doesn't have to be something that we have to cast in a, you know, like a negative light.
But it's negative. It's negative for the people who are colonized. It's negative for the indigenous people still. We benefit from it because we're privileged, and we benefit from our privilege, and we need to.
How many refugees are we taking in? And how many different government organizations do we have that are trying to do their best? And so we as the people, we are the ones that are supposed to be influencing how those things are reaching out to those people. And I understand, like, nobody's to blame here. Like, I think your points are good. I know that America has some events, and we are, you know, doing events.
Well, so I don't think this conversation is actually is certainly not going in the direction I was hoping it would go in. And unfortunately, I do have the mic. Well, I guess. Anyway, that did it. So, yeah, I don't know. So whatever. I don't think that person was necessarily going to cop to their actual true beliefs, but whatever. Maybe I'm being arrogant. Let's see. Do we have anybody else online? Not yet. 503-231-8187. That might have just dismayed people. Okay, so Erica Chenoweth, Civil Resistance, What Everyone Needs to Know, which was published... couple years ago, writes that nonviolent revolutions have indeed created major societal breakthroughs, but that there are still many people around the world who have not yet been exposed to these ideas and or who remain more sympathetic to violent alternatives and as a result default to apathy or to violence as their only options. It's a provocative thing, you know, the whole nonviolence violence debate. You know, we could get into that one too. But I actually had some other things queued up here from her book. Okay, civil resistance is a method of conflict through which unarmed civilians use a variety of coordinated methods, strikes, protests, demonstrations, boycotts, and many other tactics, to prosecute a conflict without directly harming or threatening to harm an opponent. Sometimes called nonviolence resistance, unarmed struggle, or nonviolent action. This form of political action is now a mainstay across the globe. It has been a central form of resistance in the 1989 revolutions and in the Arab Spring. It is now being practiced widely in Trump's America. If we are going to understand the manifold protest movements emerging around the globe, we need a thorough understanding of civil resistance as many dynamics and manifestations. Anyway, I think... that's a very interesting perspective. I think that there may be times when it's not sufficient, but yeah, looks like we got another caller. Whoever you are, go ahead. You're on there. Hello?
Oh, can you hear me?
Yep.
All right. Well, you know, I'm listening to the conversations and quite interesting topic. And I know, you know, everybody wants to debate the communism, capitalism thing. There is some measure of things to look at in this. And I think one of the things that we could probably do to begin to not feed this beast is to detach from its financial aspects. And we're given a tool right now that is absolutely worrying our government, and that is called Bitcoin. using this tool, learning about it.
I thought Bitcoin had taken a serious hit recently.
What do you mean by hit? All it does is it's game theory, and you have
that bank that completely collapsed, and that guy who got arrested. Anyway, I don't want to talk. I'm sorry. I just don't want to talk about this. I have to exercise my power as moderator or controller of the microphone.
No, there's a reason for it. The reason is if you have financial sovereignty, you would be able to starve the beast. You're paying.
No, I think I'm sorry. We're going to have to cut you down. I think you're deluded. I think you're hopelessly deluded. Bitcoins, basically, what they do is they suck massive amounts of energy, water, and resources in order to create the goddamn things. Maybe there's other ways to do it. They're highly unstable. The way to starve the beast is, you know, simple. Take your money out of the big banks, number one, you know, put them in credit unions, community banks, put them in, if you can share, pool our resources. If you have extra, money, pool it together and put it in some community land trusts, buy some buildings where we can have community centers. We need to bring our resources together in ways that actually leverage its effectiveness within the capitalist system, and then use it to build the resistance. That's I don't know. This Bitcoin thing, the idea that it's some sort of panacea, or, you know, everybody thinks that there's one thing that's going to solve everything, and it's either Bitcoin or something else. Anyway, 503-231-8187. Sorry to get on my high horse here, but I'm sorry. As the Wednesday talk radio host, I guess I have my own strong opinions that lead me to be impatient with certain other ones. I apologize if that offends anyone. Anyway, 503-231-8187. I guess my idea of a focused conversation isn't going as planned. Not sure why that is. Maybe because we're all in our own little worlds and we don't actually have the kind of focused conversations in small groups, in bigger groups, that might lead us to have some kind of common understandings and agreements. We don't engage in common struggle so that we're forced to have these kind of conversations. And those who do are unfortunately at this point still drastically outnumbered by the large majority of people. Harking back to my section I read from the book by Eric Fromm, in this chapter on the revolutionary character, in which they studied people in Germany at the outset of Nazism and found that 10% were kind of destined to be hardcore Nazis, 15% were destined to be anti-Nazis, and the great unwashed middle went the way we saw it. And so there you have it. So how do we strengthen that 15%, increase its power and leverage when, let's face it, the vast majority of resources are controlled by the right-wingers because, you know, the capitalists tend to be right-wingers. They tend to be those who believe in the myth of, you pull yourself by your bootstrap, the free market economy, is the best way to guarantee health and happiness for everybody, and all that. Okay, do we have another caller? Looks like we have three callers. Who's our next caller?
Jenny.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Jamie.
Hi.
Hi. I was just curious about the Eric Fromm history, the book you were just mentioning. I saw kind of like an ancestry program on YouTube about who am I, and this person she found out was in the Nazi army. She had no clue.
she had this investigated, so there was a lot of history that was brought up, of course, and you know, a lot of people, I forget exactly what year it was in the 30s, but in Germany, they could not work, and they were starving, a lot of the people. And when it comes down to basic needs, what is somebody with children going to do when they can't provide for their family? I think that's a big question that's relevant today. So they turn to extreme behaviors. Extremism.
I guess so it depends to some extent where they start out. You know, if there's a big rural urban divide, there's a big people of color, non people of color divide, big youth versus old divide, and so
exactly.
You know, and so a lot of the people who you know, who are going to resort to stockpiling guns tend to be, you know, rural, older, white Americans, and the people
exactly.
who engage in, you know, and yeah, but you're right, though. When push comes to shove, you know, what are you doing? We're so fragmented as a society. Our solidarity and support networks are strained and have greatly strained in recent times with the 2008 crash and then the pandemic. So yeah,
KBU is one of the last resorts for having these really broad, open conversations and civil discourse, for God's sakes. I mean, there's nonprofits around town that do have conversation projects that go statewide, like Oregon Humanities. I want to give a shout out to them. They are funded.
Oh, that's right. I forgot to mention them. They have been having, especially around race, yeah.
Oh my God, they do incredible work. And they do have some federal funding through the National Endowment for the Humanities. But I mean, you got to get your funding where you can get it to support your mission. And they have, you can go to get college credits through their, I forget the name of their program, but you don't have to have a degree. Say you started going to school and you had to stop for economic reasons or whatever, you can go back, get 6 credits in humanities from Bard College out in New York State, one of the top humanities programs in the country. So check out Oregon Humanities. And I just wanted to do a shout out to all the Lincoln High School kids that went down and protested downtown and protesting gun violence and seeing the emotions in their speeches on, you know, KGW, you know, mainstream TV, but there they were crying
yep.
and getting yep. angry and pissed off.
Yeah, I'd like to see how that develops. I was watching this CNN program where they're talking about the, you know, what happened in Tennessee and the latest, well, it's not no longer the latest mass shooting, but at the time, and then the uprising in the House chambers, and how they were talking about how there has really been in the past, you know, especially since, was it Parkland in Florida, if I got that name right, that school shooting, there's been a real student movement, an actual anti-NRA movement, grassroots movement has actually developed. So I think that's and that's kind of what I was pointing at with the, you know, those lawmakers going after the NRA lobbyists and joining in mostly with the youth. I think that's where I think one place we can look for some kind of, you know, larger scale activism that might shake some things up. Anyway, so thank you for calling. We can see if we can squeeze in one more caller, and we're just about out of time. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, good. Good afternoon. Good morning. My name is Natalie, and I wanted to speak to the lady who called a couple of callers ago who got a little bit upset. I think she had good points in that we can be great individually. We have to watch our language. We have to do that work in our around us and be very conscious around us. But I came late in the program, and I was wondering, are you talking about the difficulty to organize and to change the system when we work within the system?
It's I don't mean, I'm not laughing at you. It's just that we're really out of time, and that's a big question. That that's one of the aspects of it. Yes, but
okay.
But I was actually pointing to the possibility that, you know, like the legislators in Tennessee who were expelled and then at least one was reinstated, you can join elected officials with a larger scale, you know, grassroots movements and make some really interesting changes. That's what I was, the main point I was making.
But normally the elected officials should be a part of the movement. It should be, you know, with the movement. It's just that money has so much overtaken our electoral system that
right.
It's no longer
and that's part of it. That's why I was really glad to hear those two young black legislators who are going after the NRA lobbyists, because the lobbyists are the foot soldiers of what you're talking about, the distortion of the system. We got to go. Thank you, Natalie, and thank you for everyone else who called. We are plumb out of time. This is Paul Rowland, Wednesday Talk Radio. Bye, everybody.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at KBOO.FM. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at KBOO.FM. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, 'cause they own by special